This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media's Midweek Podcast, and this week, for your delectation, I hope, a conversation with my longtime WNYC colleague Brian Lehrer for Interview Magazine. For those outside the New York area, although he has countless listeners elsewhere too, Brian hosts one of the best live news and call-in shows ever. The Brian Lehrer Show has held a huge and diverse community together and kept it talking after 9/11, the big blackout, Superstorm Sandy, the death of Eric Garner, the Trump presidency, you name it. Every day he offers 2 hours of principled and contextualized conversation about news, both local and global, with the people who make it and the listeners who have to live with the consequences. Brian is a local hero. It so happens he was also the previous host of On the Media. In this chat, we share how we came to do what we do. This conversation appears in full on Interview Magazine's website with the headline, Brian Lehrer Points the Mic at Brooke Gladstone. Who starts, Brian?
Who starts? When you have two interviewers in the same interview, both of our impulses would be to start, right? To serve rather than receive. So would you like the honor?
No, you go ahead. You're better live.
All right. So I'll reach back into a little bit of Brooke history. You were working for NPR as their first ever full-time media correspondent. That much I know.
Prior to that, I had been an editor for most of my time at NPR, and then for 3 years, the Moscow correspondent.
That was the mid-90s, right? And for some reason at that point, or maybe I should say only at that point, did NPR decide to establish a position of a full-time media correspondent. What was going on at that time that triggered that?
Well, I was in Moscow, so I don't remember much, but there was suddenly a proliferation of cable services. I mean, that wasn't brand new, but suddenly everything was moving to that space. We also had the rise of online media, digital media. Matt Drudge was a huge thing. All sorts of people were beginning to migrate to the web, if not as a primary source of information back then, a prominent one.
1995 is sometimes mentioned as the year that the World Wide Web, as we know it, was really launched.
Yeah.
So obviously that was a pivotal moment.
Actually, media criticism was a pretty tiny group before the web. I mean, The Voice had a media critic. Newspapers, a lot of them didn't. They may have talked about cool shows coming up, but there wasn't a lot of journalism criticism. I don't think they felt compelled to because there weren't so many people outside with eyes on them and with a platform to share their observations.
Right.
Now, how about you prior to the Brian Lehrer Show? I know that you're a native Queensian and that your interests ranged from music to public health. And tell me how you wound up at WNYC.
I grew up in Queens listening to a lot of radio, both music and news. My parents were politically aware and musical. And in college, I kind of majored in the campus radio station and minored in my courses. After college, I was able to get what I thought was my dream job, which was an FM rock show on an Albany radio station. And they told me that besides my 5 day a week music show, I had to do something on the weekends. And I said, well, can I just come in late Sunday night and open the phones?
Wow.
To my shock, they said yes. And the reason was that in those days, even music radio stations needed some kind of public affairs credit with the FCC to maintain their licenses. And after a little while, I discovered that I was putting more energy into my once a week, middle of the night call-in show than my 5 day a week, 5 hour a day music show. So I decided to go back to school for a master's in journalism and really focus on broadcast news. And from there, I gradually wound up at WNYC.
Wow, that is interesting and a lot of stuff I didn't know. Surely you're familiar with Donald Fagen's song, Lester the Nightfly. It's about a late night DJ who opens the phones and some of the saddest and strangest voices come through.
That particular call-in show is a midnight to three show. And the thing that landed me in the Albany papers one time was not anything incisive that I said about politics or the world. It was when I had a suicide call from a listener and another alert listener called the cops who came to the studio and asked me to keep the guy on the line and try to find out his address, which I managed to do. And the cops got there and they saved his life.
It also may have been how you found out what the power of radio can be, potentially. You were instrumental in saving a life.
It was, yeah, I feel like I was a bystander, but it was probably more formative than I ever thought about at the time in terms of approaching the talk show that I have at WNYC as not just something that's public affairs in an intellectual sense, but that's relational, a community building exercise, and a tiny little relationship with each caller.
What they call nowadays a parasocial relationship. I mean, there's more intimacy on the side of the listener than on the side of the speaker necessarily, because we reveal so much more of ourselves and they are able to reveal of themselves. But nevertheless, there is a relationship, and it's one of trust and curiosity and, not to get too sticky, of service.
As it is in your case. I mean, you go deeper than people even think you're going to go when they're listening to On the Media.
I mean, I'm grateful for On the Media for forcing me to think deeply. Otherwise, I'd probably spend a lot more time skating across the surface of things. But I have a very low threshold when it comes to boredom, and I don't want to tell anybody anything that they already know.
Yeah, well, I think it's a privilege and a benefit of the jobs that we both have that it kind of prompts us toward curiosity. So one example in your case is that you wrote a book called The Trouble with Reality. Is it a rumination or ruminations on the...
rumination on moral panic in our time, which was now, consciously highfalutin.
What led you to that? And what did you mean by moral panic?
Well, Workman, the publisher, came to me. We were working on another project, and it was right after President Trump was elected. And those of us who live on the coasts and in large cities were conscious of a high-pitched scream, a wail, as it were, coming from households and everywhere across the country. This sort of, what the fuck just happened? This wasn't supposed to happen here. And they said, we want you to write something about that. And I said, look, I know how the publishing business works. I write something, it takes 2 years to come out. The world has already changed three times. I will write this monograph. It's not a book, more like a large pamphlet, in 2 weeks, and you have to bring it out in 2 months. And they did. And I was basically just answering the question, what happened? We've all had presidents elected. that we weren't crazy about. And, you know, and I'm not a spring chicken. I've seen decades of presidential cycles, and I've had my fair share of profound disappointments. But this was something else. And then what it came down to was an exploration of how we each construct our individual realities and how hard we work to maintain their integrity, how we're wired neurochemically to lie to ourselves if it keeps that worldview intact. And this was a great shattering.
Something that maybe relates to both of us is, you know, we mentioned 1995 as a kind of turning point. You were NPR's first full-time media correspondent. People reading this may not know that I hosted On the Media for the 3 years before you.
Do you remember we had lunch and I said, are you sure you don't want this job? And you said, I assure you, I don't want this job.
Well, when they moved from a part-time host to a full-time host and you became the full-time host, people don't remember that I hosted it because it was much less memorable when I hosted it. But you were a frequent guest when I was hosting On the Media. And looking back, I wonder if in those early days of the internet, you had the same feeling that I did and have changed in a similar way. Mm-hmm. Because I was definitely one of those people who fell for the utopian narrative of what the internet could be. You know, even though I was a professional journalist, I thought it was great that journalism, the collection and dissemination of information, was going to be democratized where anybody could do it. And I thought it was going to bring people together. It was going to build community and have people move out of their cable news echo chambers and other media echo chambers into having to interact with people not like them, because you could respond and interaction would take place. Mm-hmm. So now we know how polarizing the contemporary digital world has actually been. And I wonder if you went through a sort of similar evolution.
I absolutely did. There and back again and back yet again. And then there and back again. Once I was on some PBS show and they said, rate the media, you know, give it a letter grade. And I said, I guess I give it an A, B, C, D, and F. There's just so damn much of it out there. And it ranges from the greatest that ever was to the worst that could ever be. The dark side of that is the Nazi who sits at the end of the bar in Topeka, say, can cry into his beer about how horrible the country is, but he isn't going to find at that bar 50,000 people who agree with him, and he can find that online. So that strengthens those voices. One thing I think that we thought, Brian, you and I, and so many of the former utopians, was that human nature is something other than it is. It's very plastic. I used to think, well, we just get the media we deserve and we suck and therefore we get sucky media, or we are drawn to sucky media. Now I realize, with a greater understanding of how these algorithms work, that our natures are plastic, and it is profitable for these companies that rely on clicks and engagement to find eyeballs for the ads which support those services, to create engagement. And anger is a great tool to create engagement. Fear is a great tool. And so that we are manipulated not to be our best selves, but our worst selves. And that, I believe, is baked in to the way that these social media platforms are frequently sustained. And that is something I came to much later.
The trouble with reality. Wow. If we're being so manipulated by these ultra powerful algorithms, what do we do with that knowledge? The relative few people who will stop to conceptualize it that way.
Well, you can protect yourself. I think just like we need to be fair and accurate, leaving objectivity, which has been, I think, pretty much killed as a word to describe what the best journalist is, because it's impossible to achieve. I would say fairness and accuracy is within all of our grasps, and we can do that. I think we should do that as producers of news, and we can also do that as consumers of news.
Well, what's the difference between accuracy, which you embrace, and objectivity, which it sounds like you just threw overboard? Sometimes, even though I realize we are all a product of our backgrounds, I bristle at people's denunciation of journalistic objectivity as a goal, because I think that's what we're striving for. If we have any humility as journalists, we're trying to paint a full, complex picture of reality for our audiences. And so we're trying, to the best of our ability, to be objective, not just indulge in our subjectivity. So what's the difference between accuracy and objectivity that would discredit what I just said?
Well, first of all, I don't think that it's a choice between objectivity and indulging in subjectivity. I mean, but I think that a lot of this is actually a semantic discussion. Objectivity means that you go to everything with the blank mind. You haven't made any decisions. You haven't made any judgments. Well, people aren't like that. That's why I say it's impossible. We go through life. We have experience. We form judgments. We form values. That informs our work. It certainly informs yours, but it never makes you unfair, and it never makes you knowingly inaccurate. We all make mistakes occasionally. You make very few and usually correct them immediately. And that means that you are willing to listen, that you are willing to interrogate, that you're conscious of your opinions, but you also have values. I'm saying that as a word, as I understand it, it can't exist in a thinking person, because a thinking person makes choices. That's why I say fairness, as opposed to, I mean, leaving accuracy aside, that's why actually fairness is what I substitute for objectivity, not accuracy, which I think any journalist who knowingly lies is not a journalist.
I accept that and endorse this message. Can I ask you sort of...
Wait a minute, this is about me. I'm asking you something
okay,
now.
Okay, go ahead.
I want to talk about what makes your program unique in a maligned medium. Actually, we're all maligned, right? You see, Shakespeare wrote in a play, first, let's shoot all the lawyers. I've met enough people who feel that they should, you know, metaphorically shoot all the journalists. But talk radio has a bad name, mostly because of AM, when it's the most important community building mechanism we can have. And the Brian Lehrer community is one of the smartest, best informed ones there is. And it's partly because you rise above what might be expected in so many ways. You don't just give them a voice, you give them important things to talk about. And especially around election times like now, you give them this innovation, which I'm so proud of. I talk about it all the time, even though it's not mine, which is 30 issues in 30 days.
You say innovation. In a way, it's just old-fashioned public affairs.
Not like that. Not the way you do it, in a run-up to an election, so people understand what they need to consider when they become the informed electorate that they're supposed to be.
30 issues in 30 days was born during the 2004 presidential election cycle. This year, I was proud that we did that because, let's say, in New York, for example, where we both are, the race had become so much about crime one way or the other, and then the media ran with that. But again, what about healthcare? What about housing? What about democracy? What about so many other things? Abortion was the other issue that was being discussed. And of course, we wanted to discuss that too. But what we avoided, I think, was the temptation to indulge in red wave stories, which turned out to be false, because we, as a matter of policy, did not do explicit polling segments, as opposed to following the structure that we set up for ourselves, where we were going to do an issue a day for 30 minutes.
It is the polls and the prognostication that fuels every election cycle, and of course, proved to be disastrous this time around.
It makes me think again of the ways that you go deeper than people think you're going to go as host of a media show. And I want to take this in a different direction, but I think it relates back to the trouble with reality and how we interact with the media. On your show, you did a show that was hooked around the emotion of fear. And the obvious newsy angle was that Fox News had recently amped up their coverage of crime, even though crime rates had not suddenly increased. And your takeaway from that, if I heard it right, was that they were doing this as an election strategy to help the Republicans win, because ginning up fear of crime was proving an effective strategy in some cases. But then you went from there to, later in the show, a segment about horror movies. It was Halloween week also. And
exactly.
And I know you like horror movies. We once had this conversation in the office, and I'm like, no, I just want to look away. Give me a rom-com or something, you know? Why do you like horror films again?
Well, I think that I'm more naturally a fearful person than you are, Brian. I think a lot of what I do is motivated by fear, whether I'm conscious of it all the time or not. I think, therefore, I really crave the catharsis you can get by being scared in a safe place, like a movie seat or on your living room couch. And so there's certainly that. There's a sort of predictability to it, as the person we interviewed discussed, that sense that you're going to be scared in formulaic ways, which makes it even easier to take.
It's almost like a COVID vaccine, or almost any kind of vaccine for the potential illness in question, a controlled dose of fear or horror?
Possibly. After the piece I did, Becca Clark Callender, one of our producers, did a piece on Black horror in particular. And there was a maker of a horror film who talked to women who had horrible experiences during Jim Crow, and he'd used some of those tropes in these films. And he said, too much, not good, you hate it? And they said, no, we love it. It's so much easier to process when we see it this way than when it's a continuous pressure, a formless fear invading your life and your unconscious.
I think we've used our available time, and we should probably lift the curtain.
We don't have an arc. Can I offer a tribute to you? I love your program. I love what you do for New York City. I love your Queens accent. And I know that all of New York loves it too. I hope you never, ever try and get rid of it. At this point, it would be way too late in any case.
And I love your show and the many spurs that it has created, including even one of your producers winding up testifying at the Oath Keepers trial because the reporting that he did in the context of On the Media revealed so much. So keep pulling back the curtain on our media and ourselves. And we are so lucky to have you as host and managing editor of OTM and not me.
And Brian, you are so lucky not to have me host of the Brian Lehrer Show. Please keep building community and mending the community that is New York and all the listeners beyond New York, even as events conspire to tear it apart. You've built something really durable and growing.
And I think they love your New York accent too, even in Arizona and Nevada.
Well, Syosset, you know, known for its accent. You take care, Brian.
And you?
Thanks for listening to the Midweek Podcast. You can read the print version of my conversation with Brian on interviewmagazine.com. On this week's big show, out on Friday, tune in to hear about what it takes to uncover the real identity of a sleeper spy.